Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. So we're going to be bugging out today, and I'm sorry, you're going to hear me say that 20 times, but we are actually going to be talking to Pat Crowley, who is the founder of Chapel Cricket Bars. Eating insects is something we all need to get used to the idea of, and Pat's here to help us figure out how best to start our insect intake without bugging out completely over what we're eating. Pat, welcome to the program, and thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, excited to be here.
That's great. You hippie. In fact, I had a dream about somebody calling me a hippie because I was making my own food. Anyway,
I've been called a lot worse. So.
I bet you have, Mr. Insect. So let's take your biography a little bit. You started out as a hydrologist, right? So that's an expert on water.
Yeah, probably even further back. Pertinent to this project is just I had done a fair amount of world traveling and experiencing lots of different cuisines around the world and lots of cultures that eat insects. And then coming back to the United States, I wanted to kind of continue traveling but have more of a positive impact on the world. And so that's why I got into water.
And you live down in Utah now, right? But you grew up in Colorado.
Kind of all over the West. I grew up in Arizona, lived in California, lived in Colorado, and now I'm in Utah, yeah.
No wonder you want to eat freaking bugs, man. You know, you're one of those West Coast people, I can tell, you know. So anyway, so tell us, how did you get into the bug business?
Oh, I don't know how long your show is, but you probably don't have enough
minutes.
Time to really tell the whole story.
Yes,
but,
we do.
Yes.
I want every nuance because how did you get over the ick factor? That's what I want to know because we got to make everybody else get over it too.
Yeah, that's really the whole objective of our project. When I started learning about insects as a very viable protein source for moving forward in the future, kind of unknown future as far as our agricultural products and concern are the stability of our food supply. Really the main of hurdle, if you look at it objectively, if you look at it health-wise, if you look at it environmentally, it just makes sense. It's a no-brainer that we should have insects in our diet. And really the only reason we don't is the psychological one. Our culture didn't grow up with it, and so we think it's kind of gross. And so... Or some people do, anyway.
Well, I did some reading about this, and I learned that something like 80% of the rest of the world does include insects in their diet. So I think it's interesting that we have designed an agricultural system that excludes insects, but does include, you know, animals, which then consume an enormous amount of grain and water resources, et cetera. So, I mean, insects do make a lot of sense to me, but...
By happenstance that they were a part of the diet for Native Americans in this area, and then when Western Europeans expanded over to the Americas, they didn't have insects as a part of their diet, and they had much more of a monoculture style agriculture that you grew one thing and everything else was a pest, and that just pervaded, and so that's what's dictated our aversion to anything that may.
The flies or
wheat
or creeps.
Our alfalfa.
Right.
Yeah, viewing them as a pest. So that came with it, and we like to say that food fads come and go, but if you look at the length of human history, we've been eating insects a lot longer than we haven't been in the United States and Western Europe. So really the fad is not eating insects, and we're just try to bring that fad out the door here.
That's a great way of putting it. I also read that sushi probably had a similar experience when it was first introduced in this country, probably around 1965 or something. And nobody would think of eating raw fish back then. And now, of course, even little kids are eating it. It's just part of the program. So
we looked at that industry very closely and tried to model our product, our first product, off of the sushi industry. And it was very deliberate. It was very conscious on their part to, on the initial pioneers of the sushi industry in the United States to develop the California roll, which was a really gentle introduction for Americans.
Right.
You know, they turned the nori around, and what a great move. We didn't have to see the seaweed, which was such a foreign food to us. And so that's kind of what we knew we had to do, is create just a product that was a real gentle introduction for Americans to eat insects. And so we did the same thing. We took away the visual component by turning crickets into flour. We mill them down to powder where you would never have to see it. And mm-hmm. The sushi industry was very successful. And so we looked at it as a direct correlation to our project.
So let's hear about Chapel. You started the business in 2011, I believe, and you started by figuring out how to mill crickets down, and you created an energy bar, and you have different flavors. Can you talk a little bit about the product and how you guys came up with that particular model?
Sure. Yeah. So once we decided that kind of the energy bar was going to be the vehicle for introducing it. It was just a matter of the practicality of creating it. So our name Chapul is an Aztec word for cricket or grasshopper, and they would do a pretty similar process. They would just dry them out in the sun and then use stone tools and mill them down to a powder, and then they would make like a protein-dense bread. And so we knew that you didn't need a lot of technology to mimic some of that. So we did pretty similar practice. We just dehydrate them at pretty low temperatures, and then we put them through a stone mill.
Uh-huh.
And then when we sent it out for laboratory analysis, we were just amazed at the level of nutrition. It's over 60% protein.
Wow.
No sugar. So this was, you know, we knew we had our hands on this superfood, and it was just a matter of getting it out there. And so we developed initially, we have three flavors of our energy bar that we add that flour into,
mm-hmm.
and we modeled the flavor profiles around regions of the world that either eat insects now or historically did. So we have a Thailand-themed bar. Thailand, you can go walk down the markets, and there's entire food markets of insects, all different types of varieties of beetles and ants and caterpillars. And so our Thailand-themed bar is coconut ginger lime flavor with almond butter and cashews. And then we have an all-American bar named after the Chaco culture, which is a Native American culture in this area that historically ate insects. And so that's our peanut butter and chocolate flavor, that kind of all-American staple
Reese's
energy
crickets.
Bar flavor.
It's What's like that? Reese's bar, Reese's cricket bar.
Exactly, Reese's cricket bar.
Yeah, man. I could go for that.
Yeah.
And your third one is like more of a Mexican flavor, if I recall.
Exactly, yeah, kind of Mesoamerica. It's called our Aztec bar. So that one's dark chocolate, coffee, and cayenne chili.
So
pretty unique flavors. But,
what's the calorie profile on crickets? Do they have calories? I mean, there's no fat, there's no cholesterol, so it's basically just a big blast of protein, and it has some other minerals in it, as I recall. What's the nutritional profile? Let's hear that.
Yeah, so if you take a 35-gram serving, which is kind of a standard serving for any protein powder, you're going to get about 21 grams of protein out of that and about 140 calories. And that's, you know, that's mostly the protein. And so it's about less than 2 grams of fat out of that, a few carbs. Definitely some fiber from the chitin and exoskeleton. And,
yeah.
And there's a lot of health benefits with the chitin itself. You know, we evolved eating insects, and so we have enzymes in our intestinal tract that breaks chitin down to a very usable chitosan, which is currently we use it industrially. We make tissue for burn victims out of it, because it really fosters tissue regrowth, so bandages,
Wow.
It fosters tissue regrowth and lowers cholesterol levels. And it's amazing how nutritious these are. And it's just absolutely astonishing that it hasn't been a part of our diet earlier.
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting problem when you talk about that, which is supply. And I did a lot of background reading around your company and, you know, around other insect food producers and stuff. And crickets are apparently quite hard to source and quite expensive to buy. So tell me how you're managing that. And what are the challenges in terms of expanding a business like yours when it comes to finding a plentiful and low cost supply of bugs?
Sure. It's been a long path. Initially, when I first heard about insects as a food source and that could be incorporated into our diet and just needed to be done so in kind of a culturally acceptable manner, my first thought was, okay, well, I need to start eating insects. And so I actually tried to catch them originally, but I was horrible at it.
Right.
I couldn't catch any for the life of me.
You need to get a couple of kids. Kids are great at catching crickets.
Well, I wasn't, that's for sure. But so first thing I did after that was look at where I could buy them.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been growing crickets in the United States for almost a century. Started with kind of fish bait industry, and then in the 60s gravitated towards, it really expanded for the reptile pet feed industry. So I just ordered some online. And then when it started becoming more of a business, we reached out to those farmers that raised them and talked to them about their food, their rearing practices, to see if we could kind of tweak that for human consumption. And it was challenging initially because, you know, we're talking to these large farms that have very successful business models already in place.
Yeah.
And to try and get them to do something outside of their scope was challenging, especially because we were just, you know, a tiny company with no demand for our product. So those that worked with us, we're eternally thankful for. They're the true pioneers of doing it. And now, you know, 2 years after, actually next, we started in 2011. We didn't actually launch the product until 2012. And actually next weekend will be our 2 year anniversary of launching our product.
Oh, but, congratulations. This is a timely moment.
Thank you. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
But in those 2 years, it's been amazing. It's been overwhelming how many people are contacting us saying, oh, I want to start an organic cricket farm, and, you know, how do we do it? And so really the industry is starting to grow, and it is challenging right now just because it's the very beginnings of a new industry. So it's inefficient, and it's not at a scale where it can be very cost efficient. And we're competing against, you know, sources of protein that use, you know, very heavily subsidized grains as their feed source. And so it's challenging to compete at a price point right now, but you know, so were solar panels 20 years ago. The people that initially put them on their houses would never see a return on their investment, but they really believed in the cause. And because of them making those initial purchases, we have a cost effective, you know, solar panel industry now in the United States. So that's kind of how we view this. Is it may be a little more expensive as we kind of pave the way for this supply chain, but if you just look at the resource economics of resources in versus protein out, it's a no-brainer. It'll definitely be more cost-effective as soon as all the pieces are in place.
Yeah, I would imagine distribution could be one of your, even though they're light. I mean, let's backtrack for a second. How many, you need about five, what did I read? You need something like five crickets per bar?
Five crickets per gram of protein.
Right. So each of your bars is about 25 crickets, it says.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
So over half of the protein in our bar comes from the cricket. So when we dehydrate them and then mill them down to a flour, they really reduce in size quite a bit.
Oh yeah. Well, how big are your crickets? Because, like, when I see them in a pet store being sold for, you know, lizard feed or whatever, they're pretty damn small. And I read one of the places where I was reading about this, one expert was saying that the crickets that are grown here are often too small for what they want to do, what you guys want to do. And so they're having to source crickets from other countries where they do grow them larger, I guess like Mexico, South America, and Thailand, where they do grow much bigger varieties of crickets, and therefore the cost of transportation is quite high. So how are you able to deal with your cricket purveyors and say, I want you to grow them out? Because they only have a six-week lifespan, right?
Yeah, about 6 weeks to reproduction, yeah. It is challenging. We definitely, at this point, with all the regulatory kind of hurdles and unknowns that we're going through, we've stuck with domestically sourced. So we only get insects that are grown here in the United States. And we've visited each of the farms, and so we know exactly the practices that they're using, and we know exactly what feed that they're feeding them.
What are they feeding them? What do crickets eat? I mean, I grew up in the country. I mean, I don't really know what crickets eat. I guess they assume they eat leaf matter, right? Vegetation.
Exactly. Yeah, they're vegetarian, but they'll eat almost anything. And that's kind of one of the exciting things about the industry is that you can use alternative sources of feed for them. So you can use more agricultural byproduct in their feed. So you know, corn husks and things like that. Currently, we're not at that level yet. We're using just kind of a standard chicken feed right now for the flowers. We're an organic, non-GMO chicken feed that goes into it. So
that's mostly corn, isn't it?
Right now, it's mostly corn, oats. And then we're kind of trying to experiment at a couple of different farms. One of them uses, which we're really excited about, one of them uses kind of expired fruits and vegetables from grocery stores.
Right.
So they go and pick them up by the truckload.
And how much go ahead.
Oh, we're working with a couple of experimental farms that are really trying to tap into the agricultural kind of waste streams to use more of the compost, essentially. But that's the very beginning stages, and we definitely see the future of that. But it's you have to prioritize and take things in one step at a time, but that's where we'd like to head.
How many crickets do you need per week to produce? Like, give me a sense of your production scale.
How many crickets per week? Boy.
Do you measure them by pounds or by individual bodies?
Yeah.
I guess it's by the pound, right?
That was one of the challenges, is that when they sell them at the pet store, they sell them kind of per cricket. And so that's how the farmers were selling the pet stores. That's how their system was in place. It was selling kind of per unit, but they change in size. And so getting them, you know, in the food industry, we work in units of weight. And so when I order crickets, I need to know exactly how much weight there's going to be.
Yeah.
So that was one added challenge, was to get them to kind of change their scale of payment is based on weight. So we buy them by weight now. And so we just ordered several thousand pounds of crickets from one of our cricket farmers, about 5,000 pounds.
Wow. So that's a good, obviously your Food Navigator story paid off, huh? Because was it the Shark Tank episode? I read about you in Food Navigator, but I am a reader of trades. So that's where I discovered you. But I know you were on Shark Tank, and I know you've been written up in Smithsonian. And I think even The New Yorker a couple of years ago ran something about you guys.
Yeah.
Pat, we're going to take a short commercial break right now, and then we'll be back in just a minute with Pat Crowley from Chapel Farms. He's creating a cricket bar that we all need to start getting used to eating. So stay tuned for more with Pat Crowley. We'll be right back. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. We support Heritage Radio Network because all you folks listening are so genuine, so dedicated to serious food, so much a part of what this country needs to strive to become. People like you are few and far between, and it's obvious to us at Fairway that we've got to stick together. Our desire is that the word gets out about Heritage Radio Network in its support for serious food, foodstuffs that offer memorability and timelessness, authenticity and rarefied quality. This country grew too fast to have established any degree of a heritage. Europe had centuries to develop one. America has not. Heritage Radio Network serves to hasten the evolution of a society that often appears coarse and uninterested. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
And we are back with Pat Crowley of Chapel, Cricket Protein Energy Bars. Pat, this is just like, I'm just like a kid in a candy store. I'm a kid in a cricket cage. I just love this story so much, and I think you're so cool for doing this. So I want to go back to the idea of like how, like the source, because I'm always really interested in how things work. I like to take apart supply chains and examine the components. So the cricket supply chain is really fascinating to me. And I wanted to just go back so they can be fed waste materials. You're encouraging your partners to change up some of what they feed them. And so you make a distinction on your website about human grade crickets versus what go into the livestock industry via pets, reptiles, etc. So when you talk about human grade, like what's wrong with some of the other possibilities? What are they feeding, you know, crickets that are meant for reptiles that is different from what we're feeding them when they're meant for us?
Sure. So one of the differences, just for our product in particular, we found some of the people that are most receptive to it are very conscious of what's going into their food products and typically are liking more of an organic and non-GMO based food.
Right.
So that's one of the steps we've taken is incorporating a feed that goes into our crickets that is organic and non-GMO, which wasn't that big of a challenge. You can't really put pesticides in feed for insects. That's kind of contrary. That's the whole point of a pesticide, is killing insects.
Is so to kill it,
it
right.
It wasn't too big of a stretch.
Right.
Because they had to have kind of a higher quality feed. But that is one of the challenges moving forward with the agricultural waste streams, is that getting a very uniform and consistent quality of feed coming into it.
Yeah, I would think that would be quite a challenge, actually. You know,
getting that
it's organic. I mean, they can feed them pretty much whatever for anything else.
Yeah, exactly. But one of the other differences is just kind of hygiene of the rearing practice, not just the feed. And so our the facility that's kind of allotted to our crickets is cleaned on a much more regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask actually about cricket waste, because that's such a big issue in livestock. You know, managing waste for livestock is probably one of the greatest challenges the industry faces, because in these confined area feeding operations, it's, of course, you know, many millions of gallons per week. What do crickets excrete? And is it then usable for something else?
It is. I don't have the NPK breakdown on it, but it's extremely high quality. Some of the cricket farms actually do sell it as a really high-grade fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
But they are much, much more efficient at turning plant matter into an edible, at turning their feed into an edible biomass.
Right.
The feed-to-biomass conversion ratio is much greater. And so because of that, they have a lot less waste per unit of mass that they grow. So, you know, that was one of the things working as a water resource specialist.
Right.
You know, I worked in water supply for a while, and then I also worked in water quality. And a lot of our natural waterways are taking this kind of double hit as we pump a lot of water out of the river or pump water out of the ground, which declines the level of our rivers. They're reduced in their supply, and then we have this agricultural runoff that goes into a reduced waterway and increases the nutrients in it. And so it's just that much more heavily concentrated. So not only are we reducing the supply, we're degrading the quality of it because of a lot of our livestock practices. And so,
and a lot of our agrarian practices. I mean, the amount of fertilizer and pesticides that go onto a field of corn or soy, despite their GMO background, is breathtaking.
Yeah. Most definitely.
I wanted to go back to the interesting aspect of the not only the amount of nutrients involved. I'm going to read something from the Smithsonian here. This was about the tiny farms, and this is I'm sure you know about tiny farms. It's a kit to grow your own insects, right? So, and we'll be asking you about that. And I mean, I will be not we. We're not the royal we, but I will be asking you. about whether or not you're going to go into the bug business or not. But compared to beef, a 6-ounce serving of crickets has 60% less saturated fat, twice as much vitamin B12 as the same amount of ground beef. And besides being a good source of lean protein, bugs, this is something that really interests me because I do a lot of programming around foodborne illness and food safety. Bugs are genetically distant enough from us that transferable diseases such as mad cow or feral pig will never be a concern. And that's why, for more than 80% of the world's nations, insects are an essential part of daily diet. So my thread here is, since 80% of the world already eats bugs, and since you've figured out how to, you know, dry them and mill them into a flour, what other products are you considering besides your energy bar where you can use crickets in place of, you know, conventional flour, perhaps, or some conventional flour, and create other products? Do you have those in your sights yet?
We do. Yeah, we have a lot of fun in our kitchen. We have a little kind of experimental day in our kitchen.
I want to come visit.
You should. Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, man.
To.
No, I'm going to.
We take a pretty, you know, all along this has been all about spreading an idea for us and creating change for future generations. And it's pretty atypical to be able to go into a kitchen, but we take more of an open source approach and we invite anyone to come in our kitchen and cameras come in and whatnot. And so we'd be happy to have you. But anyways, getting back to your question, you know, there's more than 1,600 varieties of insects eaten around the world, and so the options are wide open. And like I said, our bar is intended to be the California role of the industry. So we've experimented with grasshoppers and waxworms and ants. Most countries that eat insects, or a significant portion of them, aren't farming them. And they're doing more of the harvesting techniques, kind of that they've been doing for you know, millennia. And so that's one of the challenges, is figuring out which insects are better to be farmed.
Uh-huh.
So that's a whole new challenge. We don't want to go down the road of producing a product that, you know, has to be harvested. And if you harvest an insect out of the wild, you have to be pretty confident that there isn't any spraying or there's no heavy metals that are going to be accumulated. So
absolutely. I mean, I was just in Vietnam and you were mentioning how Thailand has a lot of insect, dishes. And I was stunned as I walked through, you know, the mountains in Vietnam, through the paddies and stuff. And there was a lot of guys with, I saw tons of nitrogen fertilizer in bags. I saw lots of guys with tanks on their backs and spray guns, you know, to spray pesticides. And in doing the reading and preparation for this, I was reading about a woman who works a lot in Mali, where they often eat insects. And the women are, the mothers are telling their kids, don't harvest those insects anymore because they're contaminated. And so that does bring in the issue of, like, you can't harvest. You have to know where your source is. And yet there are so many options for creatures that you could be eating. Not that I really, I mean, honestly, Pat, when I looked at the rice wine jar filled with bees, my heart did not go pitty-pat with joy. You know what I'm saying? I did drink snake wine, though. I wanted to go on record that I did drink the snake wine.
Oh, wow. Good for you.
I know.
Now who's the hippie, huh?
I'm totally a hippie, my friend. I am exactly the right age, I'm sorry to say, to be a card-carrying hippie. But I want to talk a little bit more about the other insects that are available in our last 10 minutes. And like, I know you've been experimenting. Sure. So you looked at worms, various different kinds of worms. And there are larvae that are very popular.
There are larvae, yeah. Yeah, kind of larval stages of beetles. To be completely honest, I think some of them taste even better than the crickets do. Crickets also had a pretty good taste initially, really mild taste. So that was one of the reasons for going with them, in addition to the farming of them already being in place. But some of these wax worms have a really high fat content, high in omega-3s, and they're really good. Some of them taste pretty similar to bacon.
Come on.
Which I don't know. Yeah, I'm serious. Yeah, they.
But they're not smoked. They just have a naturally smoky flavor.
Just the fattiness of them. Uh-huh. Just taste. It's kind of like a mix between a nut and almost like a bacon-y flavor.
See, I love those are two things I love more than anything: nuts and bacon. I love those two things.
Yeah,
everything is improved with nuts and bacon. The problem
you
is,
definitely
I
have to come to our kitchen.
Yeah, I do. Except that you're going to have to like hide it in a hide it in a doggy treat for me. I mean, I'd rather eat a dog biscuit than a you know larva. I have to be honest.
Isn't that
with
funny?
You.
Yeah,
I've eaten a dog biscuit.
I think it'll have to be a generational thing. You know, I think the younger generations are just going to be exposed to it early on, and then have less of an cultural aversion to it, and it'll. Know, down the road and in the decades to come, it'll be a lot more common and just be so much easier. You won't have to think about things like, well, will people be weirded out by this or not?
We
have to think about on a daily basis when we're trying new products.
Well, that's why I love the idea that you figured out how to dry the crickets and mill them into a flour so that you did take away the ick factor, which is not so easy to do when you try to sell a whole, you know, like a chocolate covered ant or, you know, a worm that's been, you know, fried with chilies and garlic or whatever. I mean, you still have the ick factor, whereas in your case, it's like you have the nutritional bang for your buck. But you have no ick factor, and I'm just wondering if in your experiments, some of these other more gushy products, like the waxworm you were saying, you know, could be turned into something that did not look like a waxworm, and yet still gave you that, you know, delicious, bacony, nutty experience.
You know, even with all the efforts that we did, there's in creating the flour, there's still, you know, aversion to it, and so we definitely, when we started, we thought we were probably 5 to 10 years too early for the product. But as I said earlier, it was about spreading the idea. And so we've just paid no attention to that, to people that have a problem with it psychologically. We've been focusing on the people that were excited about it. So I think we'll probably come out with the next product probably just before people are ready for it. So if it's whole insects, you know, we'll do it before people are ready, and then we'll find the people that are excited about it and ready to kind of pioneer the industry with us.
Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly the people who tune into Heritage Radio Network are your audience, let me tell you. Yeah, my engineer Jack is ready to chow down on some cricket bars right this minute. And I think would even be willing to venture into the waxworm situation, which I have to admit, being a somewhat squeamish eater myself, I would have a harder time with. But as I said, if you were able to like turn that into a waxworm puree and, you know, put it into an amuse-bouche, you know,
sure.
I'd probably love it. You know what I mean? It's just like, as long as it doesn't look the way it looks, I can get over the psychological hump of eating an insect as long as it doesn't look like an insect, I think. And as long as I don't have to crunch any chitin, because that does kind of gross me out. I'm sorry. The chitin thing. My ex-husband wrote a very famous book about roaches called The Roaches Have No King. And he talks a lot about chitin and telomere and stuff like that. And it's just like, whoa. Too much, but that made me think of something else that I wanted to ask you, and now I've sort of lost my thread. I had a bunch of other questions for you. So we've talked about what's next, but we didn't really talk about what turned you on to the insect thing. Okay, you were looking at water, you were looking at how much water we use for agriculture, but wasn't there a particular catalyst for you? There was a Belgian guy who gave a TED Talk about eating insects?
There was, yeah. He's a Dutch professor did a TED Talk, and I just, on my way to work as a water resource specialist, I listened to podcasts and TED Talks, and I just listened to his one day, and it just kind of put the idea in my head, and then that's when I just started researching it as much as possible. So I would go and spend 2 hours in the library before work just researching as much as I could, and found, you know, every article I could just said, this is a no-brainer, going from these scientific, you know, academic articles. But there was just this conclusion at the end of each one of these throughout the decade saying, but people aren't ready for it, but our culture won't accept it, but... Yeah. And that was pretty inspiring. That was like a challenge, and you know, you can't say that unless you actually know. And so we said, well, let's see if people are ready for it. There's only one way to find out. You can't just say they aren't. You got to give them a
choice.
Give them a chance here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing that when I was doing my research, I came across a reference to an 1885 manifesto by someone named Vincent Holt. I'm sure you've read this.
Yes.
And,
oh, yes.
And he's talking about the food problems of his day, which obviously a lot of food scarcity at the end of the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution sort of getting off to a banging start with like a 2 cents a day wage. And he says, and here's a quote which just made me laugh my head off: "What a pleasant change from the laborer's unvarying meal of bread, lard, and bacon, or bread and lard without bacon. What would be a good change from that would be a dish of fried cockchafers or grasshoppers." And then the piece goes on to say, but he was innocent of the nuances of food marketing, because among the sample menus he supplied were offerings like boiled neck of mutton with wireworm sauce and moths on toast. I just love that. Moths on toast. Wireworm sauce.
That one has not come across our experimental days in our kitchen, I have to admit.
But it's only a matter of time, Pat, right? So are you ever going to go into bugging, into growing your own bugs? I mean, it seems to me that that's a pretty low-cost agricultural pursuit, given that the tiny farms will give you a startup set for practically nothing. How come you haven't started up?
You know, I wanted to start there. My background is in agriculture, and I wanted to start there, but it just didn't make sense until there was a consumer demand for it. And so what we're doing is trying to create the consumer demand that will create that pull-through demand for the agricultural industry. And so that's where the majority of our focus is the acceptability of the products and kind of the cultural biases or creating the culturally acceptable product for your everyday consumer. And so that's a full-time effort, to be honest.
Sure.
We're more than a full-time effort, and raising them seems like a completely separate product. That being said, we are in full support of the industry continuing to evolve and drive innovation in the industry of growing them. And so we're happy to support efforts.
Cool.
People regularly contact us, and we're more than willing to work with anyone or give them advice. And we're in the process of setting up some sort of grant-based program to help drive that. But as far as our personal energy is concerned, it's limited. We have to choose where we aim our poison, so to speak.
Well, I'm going to leave you with this thought, which is what you really need to do is, and I read that Jose Andres, the fabulous chef in Washington, has several insect-based dishes on his menu. And I think that because chefs are truly the drivers of change in our food business across the board, it is always the chef who is the bellwether of change and innovation and new trends. And what we need to do is introduce you to a bunch of very cool chefs and make them as interested in what you're doing as I am and as anybody else is who sees the end of water and agriculture as we know it coming sooner rather than later. So in closing, tell our people where they can find out more about Chapel and where can they buy your cricket bars.
Yeah, just they can head to our website. It's pretty easy, chapul.com. That's our name, chapul.com. Mm-hmm. And we have a little store locator. Scroll down about halfway through the main page. It says buy locally. Throw in your zip code, and you can find an area near you. And if there isn't one, let us know, and we'll reach out to somebody or reach out to them and tell them you want some cricket bars on your local shelves.
Absolutely. I think it's wise. I think we all need to start adapting to this, and it sounds like the Chapul Cricket Bar is the best way to get used to eating our chitinous friends. So, Pat, thank you so, so much for joining me today. And I hope you'll stay in touch with me because I would love to follow up and have other discussions with you about different ideas in agriculture. I'm sure you have a lot more ideas besides just eating insects and more ideas about water and what we're going to be doing about water in the coming decades. So let's stay friends forever. And again, people, check out the website, chapul.com, and order your cricket bars today. Thanks a lot, Pat. We'll see you soon.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Kate.
Thank you to my sponsor and to my engineer. We'll see you next week. Tom Philpott is joining me again to talk more about the state of agriculture as we know it. So long. Everything you do is not for you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.